Okay, good morning everyone. Perhaps we'll make a start. Welcome to the first session of this year's biennial convention. Today we have Tim Higgins. He's a senior lecturer and researcher in actuarial studies at the Australian National University, ANU. Prior to academia, Tim was with the Australian Government Actuary in the Department of Treasury. He's a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia and an associate editor of the Actuarial Journal, Australian Actuarial Journal. His main area of research is income contingent loan theory and applications. Other research interests include superannuation member behaviour, understanding and modelling financial means, needs and products for the ageing population, and financial well-being more generally, hence today's session. Tim's going to have a fairly informal, informal sort of discussion through, so he's open for questions throughout. There'll also be an opportunity at the end of Tim's presentation to ask additional questions. And if you do have a question, can you please come to the microphone and state your name and then ask your question? And I'll look out for a good spot. If during the presentation you'd like to do that, just come up and we'll take your questions from there. So I would like to introduce to you Tim Higgins.
Thanks for coming along, everyone. First thing I want to say is this is joint research with my colleague from ANU, Steve Roberts, who's attending today as well. So if we get any tough technical questions, I'll defer to Steve. The other things that I want to say at the beginning, this is very much a work in progress. We ran the survey that I'll be discussing today in August, September last year. Only started analysing the results late last year and early this year. For those of you who have looked through the paper, which is available on the website, it's a very, very long survey, about 42 pages long, multiple questions on each page. So there's a wealth of information there, and I expect that throughout the rest of 2011 and much of 2012, we'll be analysing this data. So in some sense, what I'm talking about today is a bit premature, but it gives you an overview of the survey, the broader research project that this is a part of. I do discuss some preliminary results from some interesting questions, but I think if you all come back in 2 years to the next biennial conference, that's when the good stuff will be revealed. Okay, so first up, this is part of a much broader research project, an ARC or Australian Research Council research project that the ANU was awarded back in 2008. There's components to that research project. The linkage partners are AMP and Rice Warner Actuaries. And there's a number of chief investigators, myself, Steve, and a couple of statistician colleagues from ANU and demographers from ANU as well. So the overview today is to give you a bit of a background of what that ARC project involves, and then to talk about some of the shortcomings with existing data sets, which launches into the motivation for the survey that we ran last year. And then the rest of the talk is going to go into the preliminary findings and some of the future plans that we have in terms of analysis. So background. Well, the literature on ageing and demographic change and the effect of ageing and demographic change on public resources and public spending is quite well known. Intergenerational report, obviously, Productivity Commission reports and so on. But there's relatively little research into the role of the elderly consumer of private goods and services. ASFA, NATSEM, Access Economics, or Deloitte Access Economics as they're now called, has done research into elderly expenditure, but the main focus of those research pieces has been the difference between expenditure amongst the younger population or pre-retirees and the transition to retirement and how expenditure varies at that transition stage. There's very little research into the quantitative side of variability in expenditure within the elderly population and over the course of retirement. So this research, or the broader ARC project, really intends to try and fill that gap. And the main aim, the little snapshot or the little grab that we included in the ARC research application is as follows: to examine the influence of demographic factors, financial resources on consumer needs and preferences as Australia's population ages. Sufficiently broad. And what our assumption is in this is if we can better understand the variability in expenditure needs and preferences, then we can better get a handle on how much we're going to need in retirement. So how much is needed? Well, part of our motivation here as well is realisation that one of the main measures is replacement ratios. And we all know about replacement ratios, the amount of money needed for adequate retirement, often expressed in terms of a percentage of pre-retirement income. Treasury reports on these quite regularly. A number around 60 to 65% has been bandied about. But there seems to be a lack of supporting research to support those numbers and to support those measures. So one question is an income-based measure like that really appropriate? We're also familiar with budget standards, of course, the Westpac ASFA budget standards for modest and comfortable retirement. Now, most superannuation funds use those budget standards in order to assess adequacy or retirement needs. But, of course, what might be considered comfortable for one person isn't comfortable for another, and furthermore, those retirement standards are for a person or a couple aged 70 and don't look into variability across the life stages of retirement. Brings us on to the third point. Is there that variability, and are there life stages of retirement? Rice-Warner Actuaries has talked about life stages of retirement. Mercer's has, and most organisations have. The Society of Actuaries discusses them quite regularly, the active, passive and frail or geriatric stage. The question is, do those stages really exist in a discrete form? And we know that we surmise that some individuals don't go through all three stages, but is three stages appropriate, and can we quantify what the different expenditure needs are in those different phases? So there seems to be a lack of empirical evidence and quantitative data analysis to describe how expenditure changes and to see if there is variability that conforms to stages in retirement. So before I talk about the survey that's the main topic of this talk, I'm talking about ABS data first. This is existing data that's available to analyse that captures household expenditure survey data from 2003-2004. 600 individual commodity items, cross-sectional data, so it doesn't allow us to track an individual through time, which is one of the constraints that we have. But it collects a whole range of socio-demographic and financial variables. It's collected every 6 or 7 years. The next one has already run, and the data's going to be available at the end of this year, early next year. It'll be interesting to see if that captures some of the global financial crisis as well. The point is, this is really the best and only source of data that captures expenditure amongst the population. There's approximately 1,000 singles and couples who are over the age of 55 who are captured in this data set. And the reason I've put this up is twofold. Firstly, part of the broad ARC project involves doing quite comprehensive statistical analysis of the household expenditure data. I'll talk about that shortly. The other reason is to just give you a bit of a guide to the variability that seems to exist in expenditure amongst the elderly population. So this is ages 55 plus. We have singles on the left and couples on the right. Dashed lines indicate the median. This is 2003, four numbers. I haven't tried to inflate these up. And couples here. So that's 28,000 as the median, 15,000 for the median there. But you can see there's a lot of skewness and a lot of variability. And over here, I've superimposed onto the same plots the Westpac asked for budget standards from 2003-04. The age pension is down here somewhere. Here we have the modest standard, which is about 16,000. Of course, it's a lot higher now after 7 or 8 years. And for couples, 23. Then we have the comfortable standards. And something some of you might not know is when the Westpac ASFA standards were first devised back in 1988-99 by the UNSW Social Policy Research Centre, they developed budget standards for the entire population. Retirees age 70 was just one snapshot of their 600-page report. And then Westpac ASFA commissioned them to extend on the modest standard that they had devised for retirees and come up with a comfortable standard, which they did in 2003-04. And to do that, what they did is they used the 1998-99 household expenditure survey data from the ABS as a starting point. And they embellished that with focus groups and expert judgment and so on. And since then, they've increased those levels with goods and service category-specific inflation rates and further expert judgment and further focus group studies. So when the modest standards and comfortable standards were devised, it's not that they were devised it's not that they were devised under the assumption that people only needed to spend X or Y. It was recognised that there was a lot of variability. The major reservation in using household expenditure data from the ABS and from any source is that it measures not what an individual needs, but what an individual actually spends. And of course, spending is constrained by financial resources. So, I'm not going to show you the relationship here, but if you plotted expenditure as a function of income and as a function of wealth, there's a very, very strong correlation between the two. Of particular interest, this is still the household expenditure data. Again, it's not the major point of this talk, but it's pretty interesting and it's part of the broader project. A major component of interest for us is how does expenditure vary with respect to age? Because after all, what we want to do is see how expenditure changes across the course of retirement. So here we have ages 55 plus again. These are box plots. So the bold line in each of these plots is the median expenditure. And the box itself, just ignore the end bits here and the outliers, the box itself records the upper and lower quartiles. So what you can see by this is that not only does expenditure go down as age increases, but the variability seems to decrease as well, and that's across both. So there is reduced expenditure as age increases, but you can't conclude from this in the absence of looking at or the absence of controlling for wealth and income that expenditure declines because of age. So what we've started doing is analysing and building statistical models for the household expenditure survey data. You can build regression models, Tobit regression, and various other sorts of generalized linear model methods to work out how expenditure changes with age after controlling for other socio-demographic variables, after controlling for income, after controlling for wealth, and so on. And we've done that, and we've found that, sure enough, expenditure does decline with age, even after controlling for those other variables. And similar results have been found in the UK recently. They didn't do it as formally as we've done it. There's a recent study that only came out late last year on UK consumption data, and they've found a similar result, and they've found similar results in a lot of economic analysis of household expenditure survey data as well. There's various theories as to why that is. I'm not going to go into those now. I talk about some of them in the paper. One thing that I do want to say is, two things. This is based on a cross-section in time. So if we do observe an effect, it might not be the case that it's due to age, but it might be due to cohort instead. There might be a generational component here. Now, we don't have longitudinal data, but we do have household expenditure survey data from the late 90s, from the mid-90s, from the late 80s, and all the way back. So it allows us to create synthetic cohorts or artificial cohorts and then try and isolate the age effects from the cohort effects after controlling for other factors as well as period effects. Steve and myself are planning to do that for a paper at the UNSW Superannuation Colloquium in the middle of the year. If we can get our act together and actually get it done before then, time's pressing. So I think the interesting results from this broader ARC grant will come out of that sort of breakdown of analysis. As Joanne said, please, if you've got any questions as we go, then feel free to ask away. But the household expenditure survey is limited. Firstly, it's cross-sectional. Now, I'm not saying that this survey that we're subsequently running isn't cross-sectional as well, but that's one of the limitations of the HES. But another limitation is that it's just collecting quantitative information. There's no information about what's going on through people's minds when responding to the survey. We have no idea about their concerns, about their financial behaviour in addition to consumption. For example, the strategies to manage their financial risks, what strategies are they taking, why they have made the consumption choices that they've made, and the financial decisions. Now, to try and get a handle on that would be very difficult in a survey, but we've tried to make a start on that. And if you look through the survey questions at the end of the paper, you'll see that there's a lot of open-ended text questions, which are a nightmare to analyse. It's very easy at the front end to ask an open-ended question and collect the data. The trouble is having the time and resources and skills to take that qualitative information and turn it into something useful. That's what we're going to struggle on over the next year and a half. So I'm not reporting on those results, reporting on some of the quantitative results today. So let's talk about the survey. National Seniors Australia has a database, membership database of around 250,000 members. They're always keen to involve academic researchers to analyse their membership data and to send surveys out to their member database. And the wonderful thing is that the elderly have time on their hands. If you send a 40-page survey out to my cohort, it'll go straight in the bin. But if you send it out to the elderly, you get fantastic response rates. This was a 40-page survey. It probably took between 30 minutes and an hour to complete, and we got a 23% response rate, which is very surprising. And we were very happy about that. So we received 3,500 completed surveys, and to many, it might seem that that was excessive. We didn't need to target 15,000 people. The reason it was 15,000 was twofold. One, we had the money to do that. And two, although we have 3,500 responses, as soon as you reduce the responses by those who ticked all the boxes that you want them to tick and so on, all of a sudden the 3,500 reduces to 800 or 900. And you've finally got a statistically credible sample, but you had to start with a large number. We stratified the sample by age, for ages 50, 55 plus or thereabouts, gender, and geographic location. So we've got a good spread amongst the whole population. We didn't stratify according to income or wealth. We don't have that level of information on the NSA database. So just briefly, I'll run through some of the survey themes. Again, all of this is in the paper. The survey is attached. So module one, financial well-being and risk. We ask questions about the respondents' financial well-being, strategies for managing financial risk after retirement, level of concern expressed about consequences of certain events relating to aging. And it's module one that is the main focus of today's talk. The analysis that we've done looks at two of the strategies for managing financial risk and two of the concerns. Module 2, questions are asked about respondents' needs and expenditure in retirement compared to prior to retirement. And in addition, we have some open-ended text questions asking not only if their needs have changed for certain goods and services, but if their expenditure has also changed on those goods and services and why it's changed and why they think their needs have changed. Module 3, superannuation savings and investment choices. Questions are asked about engagement with super, financial literacy pertaining to asset class risk. I analyse some of that in today's talk as well. Reactions to the global financial crisis, and again, reasons for making the modifications to their super plans that they have. Module 4, we ask about a series of unplanned events, about whether certain financial actions were taken in the event of death or illness of a spouse, involuntary unemployment, and so on. It's a real hodgepodge of different themes and different questions, and it partly arose because there's seven chief investigators, and everyone wanted to throw their idea into the mix. So there's a number of themes emerging. Module 5, unplanned events, financial gains and losses. We've got a series of hypothetical questions here. If you suddenly gain $10,000 or gain $100,000 or gain an income stream, what are you going to do with the money and why are you going to do what you do? And if you suddenly lose a substantial amount of wealth, and we give them a whole set of actions to choose from as well. Then Module 6, we have habits and intentions as well as household budgeting, engagement with a variety of sources for financial decision-making and so on. And Module 7 to 10, we collect all the background socio-demographic data that allows us to do proper analysis of this. Because at the end of the day, we don't just want to find out about their superannuation choices and so on and about the unplanned, their financial actions. We want to find out how it varies with respect to wealth, with respect to income, with respect to age and gender and marital status. So we collect that information in those last three modules, four modules. So what I'm going to talk about for the rest of the talk is a couple of questions that are in Module 1 on financial strategies and financial concerns, and also a question that tests loosely their financial literacy. And this isn't in the paper, but time permitting, I might talk about personal discount rate as well, or individual discount rate, because we try and measure that in a very haphazard way. Just before I go on, all of the analysis that we conducted, we broke into pre-retirees and retirees. Median age of pre-retirees was 59. For retirees, it was 72 for the purpose. Yep.
This is Rizwan Ali from OnePath. Did you have a question at all about retirees living with the family or living independently?
No. And again, this is one of those. We do have questions on whether they own their own home or are renting or in different accommodation setups. So if an individual is in a long-term care facility or something of those of that nature, they would have had the opportunity to respond. That said, the way that the sample was stratified, virtually, I'll just try and grab the statistic, just a sec. This is page 10 of the paper. It presents some the distribution of some of the explanatory variables that we collected in the data set. About 90% of the retirees who responded own their own home outright, and about 60% of pre-retirees. I think it's probably close to 95% of all respondents either own their own home or a mortgager or are renting. Kind of like the household expenditure survey, it's predominantly private individuals. So there is a chunk of the population that we're missing with all of this, and that's those who are very infirmed, who are staying in aged care facilities and so on. And again, this is always the way you run pilot surveys, you work for months designing the questionnaire, and then as soon as it comes in, you bash your head and think, oh, I should have asked this question or that question. Okay. So, financial strategies. This was one of the many questions that we asked. Below is a list of things some people do to protect themselves financially after they retire or as they get older. For each, please indicate whether you have done, plan to do it in the future, or have no plans to do it. The reason I have two of these in red is these are the two that I'm going to talk about today. But there's 16 that we could potentially analyse. Again, it's all in the paper. So, first up, broad results. Three quarters of retirees have either cut back or spent on spending or plan to. Again, three quarters of pre-retirees have either cut back on spending or plan to. The number, it actually sums to exactly the same. It's 75% in both cases by coincidence. But obviously, many more retirees have already cut back. Also, as expected, more retirees have obtained professional financial advice. There's a larger proportion, a statistically significantly larger proportion, who have no plans to obtain advice amongst the retirees versus the pre-retirees, and I'll talk about that in the next couple of slides. The third category I decided to put in here because it shows you've always got to question the results you get in any of these surveys, and I discussed this data in more depth in the paper, but decided not to go into detail here because it's questionable whether we pay much attention to these results given the numbers that have come out. I asked a question on whether the respondent planned to or had bought a life annuity or guaranteed income product for life. And I think a lot have misinterpreted this because there's statistics out there to show that only approximately 3% of the population purchase life annuities and guaranteed products for life, and yet we're getting numbers around 33% or 14%. And I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of the respondents here have assumed that their accounts-based pension is guaranteed for life, even though it isn't. If I had just chucked out this for life here and had guaranteed income product, then that probably would have been fine. And in hindsight, again, it would have been useful and informative to have asked a number of questions on income products. Of course, I'm not a practitioner, I'm an academic, so I'm less interested in the income product side of things as our linkage partners are. One thing that we will be doing, or we hope to do, is running a follow-up survey in the future. Out of the 3,500 who responded, 1,500 said that they would be willing to participate in a follow-up survey. So we could turn this into a mini panel and supplement some of these early questions with additional ones. I'm putting this up because it's in the paper, but I'm just going to gloss over it quickly in the interest of time. We have the proportions who have cut back on spending or obtained professional financial advice by retirement status, similar patterns with respect to age. Gender, there doesn't appear to be a big difference amongst genders for obtaining professional financial advice. There might be a difference in cutting back on spending. The question is, are those differences statistically significant? And putting up a plot like this without standard error or without confidence intervals can be pretty deceptive. So, and we are statisticians after all. So, Steve and myself took it that step further and ran logistic regression models on the results. Now, logistic regression is a useful technique when your response variable only has two levels. If it's got more than two levels, you can use multinomial logistic. Now, what we've done for the sake of this talk is use logistic regression, and we've condensed the categories where we have already done and future into one response, and no plans is the other, and we've ignored the unsure. But in future analysis, we'll be looking at all three or all four categories. So this is a bit difficult to interpret. So we'll just cut to the interesting parts. When we carried out logistic regression on cutting back on spending for retirees, we found a couple of variables, or four variables, that were highly significant: net wealth, gender, self-assessed financial well-being, and age. And self-assessed financial well-being was one of the first questions we asked. So what I have here is the probability that someone will cut back or has cut back on spending. Blue is men, red is women. So immediately we can see that if we just compare these two bold lines, we can see that women have a much higher probability of cutting back on spending than men. And that appears to be the case for both retirees and pre-retirees. Now, whether that reflects risk tolerance and optimism, or pig-headedness, as my wife would say, who knows, but it seems to be a real effect, and it's statistically significant. The other thing to note here is, as wealth increases, so 250,000 to 800,000, if we compare this blue line with this blue line, the bold lines and the dashed and the other dashes, the difference there indicates level of self-assessed financial well-being. I'll talk about that shortly. But the point here is, as net wealth increases, the probability of cutting back on spending has decreased, as you'd expect, but it doesn't decrease markedly. What has a huge impact is one's own perception of their own financial well-being, which is obvious. It's one's own self-assessment of financial well-being. So here we have very good financial well-being. Here we have fairly good. And the probability jumps by 20 or 30%. Finally, and probably of most interest, is age. Somewhat surprisingly, it seems to be the youngest retirees who have the highest probability of responding that they've cut back on spending or intend to cut back on spending. You can see that by here. And there's also quite a large drop at the older ages. Now, for the younger generation, perhaps it's the younger retirees are simply overestimating the future need to cut back on spending. And perhaps the reality is that that these young retirees will find that fewer of them have to cut back than anticipated, and the proportion will drop down to a consistent proportion of the middle-aged retirees. Of more interest to me, at least, is what's happening at the tail of this distribution. So what this is saying is that it's the very old who have not, or who have claimed that they have not cut back on spending. A smaller proportion have claimed they've not cut back on spending, nor intend to in the future. So perhaps, and I'm just speculating now, perhaps it's a cohort effect. Perhaps the older generation have learned to live within their means better than younger cohorts. Analysis of the HES certainly supports that expenditure drops down as age increases. We're yet to analyse that to determine whether there is a cohort component there, but I think analysis of the HES data will shed light on this further. So in other words, the hypothesis here then is perhaps the older generation are better at smoothing consumption.
I'm Gary, or perhaps they actually cut it back 30 years ago and don't remember they actually did it.
Well, that's possible as well. Yeah, very possible. We are talking about people over the age of 80 here, 80 or 90. So pre-retirees. For pre-retirees, age, gender, net wealth aren't significant. As before, self-assessed financial well-being is. It's probably hard to read this. That says, by frequency of keeping track of savings and investments. That was one of the questions in Module 6. So those who most frequently keep track of their finances, in other words, those who are most likely to budget, are those more likely to reduce savings, which is intuitive. Perhaps it reflects a more cautious or risk-averse nature. Engagement in one's finances leads to more recognition of financial inadequacy. The other interesting result of superannuation here. Those who are in more conservative investments have a higher chance of cutting back on savings. And conversely, those in growth, less chance. It could be due to the awareness of the relationship between growth and returns, and also optimism. I'm not going to bombard you with plots for every question, even though we're only looking at a handful of questions, so we'll run through this one fairly quickly. Obtaining professional financial advice. Less education is associated with a decreased likelihood of seeking advice, as expected. For age, there's a large drop. And we'll go back a couple of slides. For age, you can see that there's a large drop in seeking advice or using advice for the very old. Now, maybe Gary's comment still holds here, and maybe they can't remember that they used advice. But it's also possible that it is this oldest group who didn't need the advice, because after all, many of them will have never received the superannuation guarantee. They'll have retired before that kicked in. Their financial situation is presumably much less complex and therefore less need to seek that advice. 35 minutes, okay. For pre-retirees, similar sorts of results. Though marital status, income and health are significant, they're not material, so they don't really have a large impact. Some evidence that those with poor financial literacy are less likely to use advice. In other words, those who need it the most may be those who are least likely to obtain the advice. Moving on, financial concerns. We asked two questions. Well, we asked eight questions, but I'm only going to be talking in detail about two now. One of them is you might not be able to keep the value of your savings and investments up with inflation, and two, you might outlive your savings. Now, motivation for this question came from the Society of Actuaries 2009 Risks and Processes of Retirement Survey, which is available at the Society of Actuaries website. We posed this question using the same language for the most part because we wanted to be able to do a cross-country comparison. And what I've done here is presented the six out of the eight categories of response. The numbers out of the brackets are the Australian results. The numbers in the brackets are the US Society of Actuaries results. And the main thing to emphasise here is savings not keeping up with inflation is the largest source of concern amongst Australian pre-retirees and Australian retirees and US pre-retirees and US retirees. So we're consistent in our level of anxiety over inflation. And the numbers seem to be pretty consistent too, 64, 58, 67, 71 within the bounds of statistical uncertainty there. Next off the rank, a close second for Australia is that pre-retirees won't be able to maintain a reasonable standard of living, followed by concern they might outlive their savings. So in the interest of time, let's jump ahead. So inflation concerns for retirees. Again, we carried out logistic regression. We combined very concerned, somewhat concerned into one category, not too concerned and not at all concerned into another. The probability here in the y-axis records the level, the probability that someone's very concerned or somewhat concerned. Some of these results are as expected. Those with greater financial well-being are less concerned. Very good financial well-being, less concerned. Those with higher wealth are less concerned. But there's also some interesting results that say things about engagement. We have those who regularly consult with professionals, at least quarterly as opposed to never, are more concerned. Those who regularly keep track of the value of their savings and investments are more concerned than those people who never keep track or those who rarely keep track. So again, more financial engagement, more level of concern, or another way to put it, ignorance is bliss. Age is significant, though not plotted here. Finally, health is significant, such that very good health is associated with less concern, which is somewhat surprising. I'll talk about that in the next slide, because that result also appears relevant when we look at the probability of outliving one's savings. First up, the probability decreases as age increases, which is expected. Your life expectancy is shorter. You don't need as much money. And this is for someone with the same level of wealth and the same level of income, so you'd expect that to go down. Also, you'd expect the probability to go down dramatically as self-assessed financial well-being goes up, and that's the case here. That's very good financial well-being, very low probability of being concerned that you outlive your savings. The interesting result in my mind is health here. We have those in excellent health are much less concerned than those people in good or fair or poor health. Now, this is after controlling for income and wealth. So we've got people with the same level of income and the same level of wealth and the same age, and yet those people in excellent health are a lot less concerned than those people who aren't in excellent health. And one might think that, well, perhaps those people in fair or poor health have higher health expenditure, out-of-pocket costs, and therefore they spend more, they're going to deplete their savings more readily. It's a reasonable hypothesis. What is unusual, though, is that those who still record their health as very good have much higher concern than those who record it as excellent. And it could be that those who do self-assess as excellent have an optimism bias, and those who don't aren't as optimistic. And it could be that that optimism bias pervades other aspects of the survey. We're yet to do that analysis, but it is possible that those who have excellent health also answer questions in a very optimistic way for many of the other questions, and that's something that we'll be looking at in future research. Financial literacy. There were two questions in Module 3 that we asked. In hindsight, we should have asked this to all respondents. We just asked it to those who had superannuation. Don't ask me why at the time. It was in the superannuation section and following on from questions about their investment choices. We ask about their level of knowledge with respect to risk and asset class. And just looking at the overall results, we find that about 50% or 60% of men, 40% of women answer this question correctly. So about 50% financially literate when it comes to an understanding of the relationship between risk and asset classes. As expected, those who have retired, those who are younger, who may have just accessed their superannuation or haven't really thought about it as much, don't answer as correctly as those who are age between, say, 60 and 74, who will be more engaged in their superannuation because they'll have seen a financial planner or they'll have accessed the superannuation. Those who in the elderliest group are those who have the lowest financial literacy. Again, not unexpected. Many of these will never have had superannuation and won't know an equity from a fixed interest security. None of the results here are particularly surprising. I think the one to point out is that those who invest conservatively are more knowledgeable, and those who don't know where their super is have very little literacy, which is obvious. The fact that those who invest conservatively are those who are most financially literate in this context isn't surprising if you think that those who do invest conservatively knowingly accept an expected modest return, and they do so likely in the context of reflecting on what the alternatives would be, and in particular the risks of those alternatives. So in my mind, that's not too unsurprising. There was another question on discount rate. I'll just run through the main result of this very quickly. Hypothetical questions are always tough. And you might want to have a guess on what you think the number will be here. It's a big number. Anyone want to guess? So the median is 50%. Or 15,000 for men, and 100% for women. And there's a large range, and these numbers are pretty comparable with other studies that have asked similar hypothetical questions. And of course, the question that we asked is for a set amount over a set time period, and you ask for a different amount over a different time period, you're going to get different answers. There's a huge branch of economic theory and empirical economics that just looks into this with hyperbolic discounting and so on. We're not trying to add to the literature. What we're really trying to do is take the result from this and then use that as an explanatory variable in some of the other analysis that we do, or correlate this with financial literacy and so on. Just briefly, the results from this are kind of as expected. There's relationships between, there's relationship between gender, but also net wealth as well. So those with low net wealth, who are in more of need, in more need of immediate funds for current consumption, are going to place a higher value on $10,000 than those with high wealth, and that's reflected in the results. So, how's the time, Joanne? 45 minutes. Okay. So let's just summarise some of the main results here. Three quarters cut back or intend to cut back on spending. Three quarters obtain or intend to obtain professional financial advice. Spending is less like the interesting results, as far as I see it, the ones that require more analysis moving forward. Spending is less likely to have been cut back for ages 80 plus. The question is why. Maybe there's a cohort effect. Maybe the elderly are better at smoothing consumption than the younger retirees. Financial concerns, two-thirds concerned about inflation eroding their savings. Concern drops off after age 75, around 60, 50% concerned about outliving their savings. Again, we have a somewhat interesting result, less concern among those in excellent health, which requires a bit more analysis of the data amongst those in excellent health. And finally, about these two questions, We noted that there's less chance of cutting spending for the least financially engaged, less chance of seeking advice for the least financially literate, less concern about inflation or outliving saving for those who never consult, less concern about outliving savings for financially illiterate pre-retirees. So, again, ignorance is bliss. And if we are to improve financial engagement, we need to be aware that by doing so, we're going to be increasing the anxiety levels of all those retirees who currently don't know a share from a fixed interest security. The results for financial literacy and the discount rate are as expected. If you think 50% is as expected, it seems to be consistent with what other studies have found. Very high discount rate. Again, it points to low levels of financial engagement and fairly high apathy. Mind you, the most apathetic of all are probably the ones who didn't bother filling in the survey. So there could be some bias as well. So a few interesting results there, but that's a handful of subparts of very few questions that we've looked at so far. Tons remains to be done. The really interesting questions are the ones that we're going to be looking at moving forward. The financial concerns and financial actions questions we looked at, we'll be looking at all the categories, and also the correlation between those groups. Do concerns that an individual express match with the strategies that they've taken or intend to take? Is there a difference between the needs and the consumption patterns in retirement? Why is less spent post-retirement on certain goods and services? Instead of recording that less is spent, we've got these qualitative questions that we can try and interpret. Preferences for short-term consumption over savings. What decisions are made when extra funds are available? We have a hypothetical question where we give an individual $100,000 and then we give an individual an equivalent amount as an income stream, an actuarially equivalent amount as an income stream for a 65-year-old, and we ask what their choices would be under those two scenarios and why they're making the choices they're making. Financial behaviour when faced with unexpected adverse events, how do they react? Lots to do with financial loss with regards to the GFC and also with regards to a hypothetical event. Are the actions and choices related to level of risk aversion? Do the actions and choices vary by age? A lot of the questions are asked not because we're testing a particular hypothesis, but because we had an opportunity to ask these open-ended questions, and we don't know what we're going to get until we analyse the data. And that's one of the interesting things about this sort of research. Risk preferences, can we categorise individuals according to their financial risk preferences? There's a lot of questions that we've gathered that may proxy for level of risk. Changes in financial behaviour when faced with loss, ownership of insurance, household budgeting, discount rate, financial preparations that they've taken. We expect some level of correlation between the responses that they give to all those sorts of questions. And the final thing to say is that we will be, we hope to run a follow-up survey, funds permitting. We have 1,500 individuals who have said they're willing and able to participate in a follow-up. It would be a shame not to use that resource. We have also the ability to track the same individuals. There's an identifier so that we can see how their responses to the first wave have related to their responses to the second wave. Whether we even move that further forward beyond two stages remains to be seen. So I think that's it. I'm happy to answer questions now or during the convention. And also you can email me at tim.higgins@anu.edu.au or Steve as well, given he's co-author. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Tim. Now, it's over to you, the audience. If you'd like to come up to the mic, please. Don't forget to say your name first and then your question.
Mary Frances Miller from the US. I wonder if the response in the aged folks that they don't intend to cut back or haven't cut back on spending is perhaps due to the fact that because of age, they cut back on spending for other reasons than because they're worried about their ability to meet their needs. So they don't, perhaps they have actually cut back on spending, but it was not an intentional change, whereas at age 60 you say, yes, I'm going to cut back on spending. So they haven't felt a need to cut back on spending because their needs have changed.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. And some of the theories behind why consumption has changed over or with respect to age is because needs change. There's less desire and less ability to travel, and caloric consumption changes as well. I'll have to relook at the wording of the question, but there's always that possibility of interpreting it in one way, whereas we intended for them to interpret it another. That's a good point. Thanks.
Do you know, I'll throw in a quick question while you're all... Oh, actually, we've got one from the floor here.
Kathy Lynn from Jamaica. I noticed you're doing the survey on household expenses, but I just wondered, what about medical expenses? Mm. In Jamaica, pensions are so small that it's not even food and electricity that's the cost. It's medical care that just wipes out the whole pension.
The ABS household expenditure data collects out-of-pocket healthcare costs as well, and expenditure on private health insurance. So health expenditure is one of the categories that's captured there. Some colleagues of ours at ANU have done separate analysis just looking at the out-of-pocket healthcare costs as a function of a variety of the demographic variables. And when Steve and I are analysing the HES data in more detail, we won't just be doing it at aggregate level. We'll be doing it at individual goods and services category. There's 12 goods and services categories, and we'll be doing that for the broad ones, the main ones, the essential goods and services, and health is one of those. So it's a good point. Yeah.
Sean McGinn, a question on the economic position of your survey. You mentioned it earlier that those who are more inclined to fill up surveys do so. And I'm just wondering how much can we draw from the full population?
Sure. Example. I think there's I think any survey is faced with this problem, of course. We've done our best to try and mitigate that by stratifying in the first instance by age and gender and geography. But there is a point that to become a member of NSA, there's a fee involved. It's a small fee, but there is a fee. And so automatically, we would expect that the population in the sample is of higher income and higher wealth and higher means than the general population. What we haven't attempted to do so far is compare our population with the wealth and income of the broader population. We have the means to do that because we've collected income and wealth data. So before we make any bold inferences, we have to look into that.
That's just one last question for you on your discount question, which was indication, I guess, of our financial literacy in our retirees as a whole. But even so, perhaps surprising for all of us, that additional work regarding discount rates, maybe in a different context, Tim?
Yeah. There's, I think in the first draft of the survey, I had a page of questions testing discount rates under different scenarios, looking at $10,000 and $50,000 and $100,000 and different levels of wealth and different time periods. There's pretty comprehensive economic studies that have looked into this. And it seems to be that all of the studies that people take note of nowadays are real studies, whereby you get a whole bunch of people in a room to participate, and you don't give them a hypothetical scenario, you give them a real scenario. You say, I'm going to give you $100 now or $150 in a year from now or in a month from now. And they actually come up with the cash and enter into agreements with the participants of the experimental design. And we're talking about substantial sums of money in some cases. They do it in a random way where they say, not everyone of you is going to be in this position, but one of you out of the group of 10 will get that money. And then it's going to change the preferences that people state and their decision, the decision that they make, because there is a chance that they actually gain that money. There's a study in Denmark that was done fairly recently, and they found that when they did this with real amounts of money, the discount rate was around 25 to 30%, which is lower than what we got, and it's lower and you'd expect the real rate to be lower than what you get in a hypothetical study, but they're still very substantial. There's another study that the U.S. military has done, which is a real example on benefits. You could, I imagine, if you had the data and you had some good background socioeconomic variables, you could do the same sort of thing for the CSS, PSS, or some of the public sector superannuation schemes, given that so many people seem to take the lump sum over the annuity, despite the attraction, the obvious attraction of the annuity, and there's an implicit discount rate associated with that sort of decision. Of course, I don't think we have all that background information that would be useful, nor do we have access to the data. I should probably talk to Mercers and see if they've thought about doing that.
I think I better wind it up at that point so that we move on to our next session promptly. So I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Tim for his presentation, some intuitive findings and some not so intuitive findings perhaps, particularly around the financial literacy, even if we know that people have poor financial literacy. There's lots more to be done, which is the next phase for Tim and Steve, and some quantification work around that and the items that came up actually in our discussion points around particular goods and services, for instance. So we look forward to that part coming out in the next biannual convention, right? That was a commitment, guys. So can you put your hands together, please, and thank these two.